This is the second day of this April 2008 seven-day session. And we'll return to our text from yesterday, collected talks of the Japanese Zen master Basui. And this is from the book Mud and Water, translated by Arthur Braverman. Yesterday we discovered the biographical outline of Basui's life, and now we'll start on part one of his talks. A layman asked, "What is the true meaning of the statement, outside the sutras, without reliance on words?" This is a slightly different translation. The usual translation is that Zen is considered the school that is outside the words and letters without reliance on the sutras. So that this is something that we, I think many of us, just take for granted. Of course, who would want to just read the words of the Buddha and study them rather than experiencing his own experience? But there are by far vastly more monks and lay people, nuns, throughout the history of Buddhism have done just that. Their main practice has been reading and studying the sutras and other practices, but not just the pure direct experience of the Buddha's mind, which is what we're aiming to do in our zazen, this mind that is beyond form, beyond phenomena. So this questioner asks, what is the true meaning of this? Outside the sutras, not through words. The master called to him at once. Koji, which is a term for lay students. Koji, yes? The master said, from which teachings did that yes come? The layman then lowered his head and bowed. There is a koan in the Mumonkan, Sozan and Por Seize, where the monk Seize goes to Master Sozan and he says, I am poor and alone. I beg you to make me rich. And the master says, Venerable Seize, yes? You have drunk 3 cups of the finest wine of China, and yet you say that your lips have not been moistened. Do you see what's happening there? Ralph, yes? There. What is lacking? This no-gap response is very much admired in Zen because it reveals the intimacy between caller and answerer. It's part of training to learn to respond immediately when called without the intervention of thoughts. Even just a half a second gap invites thoughts into the mind. Koji, yes. From which teachings did that yes come? The master then said, when you decide to come here, you do so by yourself. When you want to ask a question, you do it by yourself. You do not depend on another, nor do you use the teachings of the Buddha. This mind which directs the self is the essence of the transmission outside the sutras and not through words. It is the pure Zen of the Tathagata, the Buddha. Clever worldly statements, the written word, reason and duty, discrimination and understanding cannot reach the Zen. One who looks penetratingly into his true self and does not get ensnared in words, nor stained by the teachings of the Buddhas and patriarchs, one who goes beyond the singular road which advances toward enlightenment and does not let cleverness become his downfall, will, for the first time, attain the way. Notice this phrase, not stained by the teachings of the Buddhas and patriarchs. How can the teachings of the Buddha himself and the great enlightened masters, how could we be stained by this? The same way that we can be stained by the words of an ordinary teisho. That is, if we cling to them, if we grasp at them and try to, if we get attached to them, if we get attached to the words, then we are stained by them. I always say what I want most of anyone who hears a teisho of mine is to immediately forget it afterward. It's not in the remembering it. It's not in learning. You notice he specifically mentions cleverness. To not let cleverness become one's downfall. Perhaps he could see that this layman was relying on his cleverness in the question he asked. This, by being there in person, he could sense, maybe, that this was not a heartfelt, genuine, sincere wondering on the part of this questioner, but was some kind of a clever challenge. It's another principle of Zen that you come to understand through the koans is the masters in these responses, they're not just answering. They're not giving classroom answers that would apply in all cases. These are not general issue answers. They may apply to many people, or they may be targeted or adapted to that questioner and what's going on with her or him. He goes on, this doctrine of non-dependence on the sutras is not a way that was first set up by the Buddhas and patriarchs. From the beginning, everyone is complete and perfect. Buddhas and ordinary people alike are originally the Tathagata. The leg and arm movement of a newborn baby is also the splendid work of its original nature. The bird flying, the rabbit running, the sun rising, the moon sinking, the wind blowing, the clouds moving, all things which shift and change are due to the spinning of the right Dharma wheel of their own original nature. They depend neither on the teachings of others nor on the power of words. It is from the spinning of my right Dharma wheel that I am now talking like this, and you are all listening, likewise, through the splendor of your Buddha nature. The substance of this Buddha nature is like a great burning fire. When you realize this, gain and loss, right and wrong, will be destroyed. Life, death, and nirvana will be yesterday's dream. The countless worlds will be like foam on the sea. The teachings of the Buddhas and patriarchs will be like a snowflake over a burning red furnace. Then you will not be restrained by Dharma, nor will you rid yourself of Dharma. You'll be like a log thrown into a fire, your whole body ablaze, without being aware of the heat. He's talking about someone who is beyond thought, someone who is so thoroughly merged with practice that there is no self left, no other. He's offering the view, the understanding of enlightenment when he says that the leg and arm movement of a newborn baby is the splendid work of its original nature. The bird flying and so forth. The calling of the geese overhead. Chirping of the bird, all things which shift and change are due to the spinning of the right Dharma wheel of their own original nature. People running to Doksan, the monitors walking through the Zendo, people returning from Doksan, that very movement is the functioning of this true mind. He continues, when you have penetrated the truth in this manner and do not stop where practice and enlightenment show their traces, you will be called a Zen practitioner. He says, do not stop where practice and enlightenment show their traces. In other words, are not caught in notions of practice as some special thing apart from one's life, or enlightenment as some special place apart from where one is at this very moment. To go beyond those notions. He goes on, there was the Zen master Ejo of Nangaku who excelled in learning the sutras. Before reaching enlightenment, he had an interview with the sixth patriarch. The sixth patriarch asked, what is it that comes in this manner? Ejo could not answer at that time, but carried his doubt with him for 8 years. Doubt here, of course, meaning his questioning, his perplexity, his wondering. He then came to a realization and went to see the sixth patriarch again. The sixth patriarch said, what is it that comes in this manner? Ejo replied, one word of explanation already misses the mark. The sixth patriarch said, this is still a disease of the mind. So Ejo took leave again and once more spent 8 years with this doubt. Finally, having experienced a great awakening, he returned for an interview with the sixth patriarch. The master again asked, "What is it that comes in this manner?" Edzo replied, "It's not that there is no realization, but that it doesn't defile me." And the sixth patriarch accepted this response immediately. It's not that there is no realization, but it doesn't defile me. This is realization that is beyond realization. No attachment to it. This comes out of the direct experience that enlightenment is not something that one can gain. It's our nature. We are all equally endowed with this enlightened nature. How can you gain what you've always had? And then Basui says, "If you were asked now, who is it that comes in this manner, how would you reply?" Who is it? What is it? How would you reply? He continues, "If this were something which could be grasped through words and sutras, why couldn't the learned Nangaku, that's Edzo, come up with a word to answer the sixth patriarch? If Nangaku, not yet having attained enlightenment, were to answer in his ignorance, using his common sense and knowledge of the teachings, he might not have attained Satori. Aside from one who instantly penetrates enlightenment with a one-word response, it is rare to find one in this world who, like Nangaku, has directly experienced enlightenment to its core." Just as a side note here, Nangaku then went on to become the teacher of the great Basso, Mazu. And Matsu, in turn, left 139 enlightened disciples. "Truly, one who understands Dharma is to be venerated. He is the master who, for the sake of others, and in accord with their various stages of development, points them directly to their own mind. But there are those who, hearing a word from a teacher, have a great enlightenment in which they lose their body and life. Some, alas, after 3 to 5 days, resolve their doubts, while others take as much as 3 to 5 or even 10 to 20 years before resolving their doubts. We tentatively give this period of doubt the name grappling with one's koan. Though the words may differ, and some may realize enlightenment quickly, while others take a long time, when realization comes, everyone wakes up to his original nature in its perfection. This realization is not based on words or phrases." You notice this word, alas. He says, "Some, alas, after 3 to 5 days, resolve their doubts, while others take much longer." Without the accumulation of this doubt mass, this questioning. The awakening is almost sure to be very faint. And can then, for some people, it can be sufficient. It clears up some unrest in their mind, in their heart, and they go their way, having had this little squeaky little insight. This famous saying by a Chinese master, small doubt, small awakening. No, great doubt, great awakening. Small doubt, small awakening. No doubt, no awakening. The questioning is can be likened to kind of a winding up a mechanical toy or something where the more times you turn it, the more tightly it gets coiled, and the more potential energy can be released from that. The difference between Zen and the teaching sects is like the difference between one who gets hit by an arrow and dies on the spot and one who sees the incident and stands on the side saying this and that about why the person died. Here, the death is a positive thing, dying to the ego. The one who sees directly into his own nature is the Zen person. The one who talks about it is from the teaching sect. It is like one having the knowledge of the hotness of fire and the other diving directly into it, cutting away the roots of his life and his understanding from a human standpoint and becoming one with the fire. Well, this is preaching to the choir. Anyone who comes to a seven-day sesshin is finished standing on the side and talking about it. Someone asked, the Buddhas and patriarchs use so many methods and means in their teachings. How can there be nothing outside of seeing into your own nature is Buddhahood? Please elaborate on this. Basui responded, I became a monk in my later years, never learning the sutras. You tell me what dharma there is other than seeing into your own nature is Buddhahood. Questioner, according to the sutras, the world-honored one attained Buddhahood after mastering the six perfections. How can this be called seeing into your own nature? The master replied, what are the six perfections? And this is, I once did six teishos on the six perfections. They're also called the six paramitas. These are the qualities developed through practice and also the qualities we want to cultivate to experience our true nature. When he asks, what are the six perfections? Surely he knows what the six perfections are, but perhaps it's just a... He either actually asked that, so the questioner would first lay it out, or it's just a device that the editor used to present it for the reader. And the six perfections, the conventional understanding or explanation of the six perfections is dana, or giving, shila, or keeping the precepts, morality, patience, effort, meditation, and wisdom. These are the six paramitas, the six perfections. And the questioner here explains the ordinary, conventional definitions of these six. Giving one's possessions to all without discrimination is called dana. Keeping all the precepts and so forth. I won't go through that. But then Basui it's his turn. He said, all of these bring you fortune for which you can secure a life in the world of humans and heavenly creatures. The human and the deva realm, these are the two highest realms of unenlightened existence, but still unenlightened. So Basui is saying, yeah, if you cultivate these six precepts, it certainly will do you good, and you won't sink into the lower realms of unenlightened existence. He says, performance of these acts is commendable when compared to the acts of evil people. Minds that covet, harm others, are immersed in hatred, are lazy, lack faith, are unstable in thought and action, and ignorant of the way. Evil people who fall into the three evil realms. But one cannot expect to obtain Buddhahood from them. The six perfections which the Buddha practiced are the right dharma of seeing one's Buddha nature. So remember in the Hakuin chant that we recite right before Teisho, there's this line, upholding the precepts, repentance and giving, the countless good deeds and the way of right living, all come from Zazen. And that's exactly the point that Basui makes here. And he starts with the first precept, the first perfection, dana, or giving. He says, the true light of one's original nature lights up 10,000 precious qualities and distributes this light equally in all directions to people in accord with their needs. This is called dana. And next he takes the morality. Buddha nature is pure from the beginning, the master of the six sense organs, yet not stained by the six pollutants. The mind and body of one who realizes this will naturally be in harmony. He will not go out of his way to make the appearance of one keeping the precepts, nor will he generate evil thoughts. This is called Shila, or morality. The next one is patience, or forbearance. Since the constancy of Buddha nature doesn't make any formal distinction between self and other, one who is in harmony with this will neither be angered when chastised, nor rejoice when revered. This is called patience. The next one is effort. Buddha nature is originally possessed of considerable benefit. It brings all merit to its completion, developing myriads of dharmas. It passes on into the future, having no limits. This is called effort, virya. Next is meditation. Buddha nature is unchanging, detached from all phenomena, goes beyond sects, forsakes rules, doesn't distinguish between sages and ordinary people, and is not confined by words nor colored by values of good and bad. This is called dhyana, or zazen. And then the last one, prajna, wisdom. Buddha nature is clear in itself, lighting up 10,000 human qualities. Is the eyes of sages and ordinary people alike, lighting up the world like the sun and moon. It is the light which sweeps across the past and present, the boundless truth of pure light. This is called prajna, wisdom. So, of course, the point he's making is that it's all of these qualities, these six perfections, are resolved by seeing into one's nature. This is our nature, these qualities. And coming to enlightenment is to embody these six perfections. It's full enlightenment. That's why we, in the Zen tradition, we don't pay a lot of attention to these groupings of doctrinal things like the six perfections and there are all kinds of things in Buddhist doctrine because they all are realized through seeing into one's own true nature. Questioner, if one sees into his inherent nature immediately, if one who sees into his inherent nature immediately attains Buddhahood, would he possess the six supernatural powers enjoyed by Buddhas? Okay, so they said in popular Buddhism that the Buddhas have these six supernatural powers. Basui, seeing into one's inherent nature is possession of the six supernatural powers. Questioner, seeing into one's inherent nature is one of the six supernatural powers. How can you say it's all six? Basui, Buddha nature is from the outset master of the six sense organs. To keep this master pure and not to be stained by the six dust-producing senses is called the supernatural powers of the Buddha. Questioner, that's not what I heard. As I understand it, the six supernatural powers are clairvoyance, clairaudience, mind reading, knowing past lives, the power to fly through the air, and the power to stop deluded thoughts. How can one attain the six supernatural powers through this one attribute? Basui, why should this limitless wonder of our inherent nature be nothing more than the six supernatural powers? This infinite light shines of its own accord and watches over all. It is nothingness. It is a wonder. It is silent. It illumines. Though forms can be seen, one is not deluded by them. This is clairvoyance. And then he takes the next one. Buddha nature is pure and unstained. When sounds are heard through the ears, the echo of vibrations is clearly discerned, and yet there is no dependence on discriminating thoughts. This is called clairaudience. When you clearly understand the nature of your own mind, you will realize the oneness of the minds of the Buddhas of the three worlds, the patriarchs and ordinary people of this world, and various heavenly beings of other worlds. This is the power of mind reading. So, of course, in each case here, he's taking the power beyond the ordinary or conventional interpretation of it and seeing it in a more profound way. And then he takes the power of knowing past lives. From the moment you realize your inherent nature, your mind will penetrate through eons of emptiness that preceded creation through to the endless future. Clear and independent, it will not attach itself to the changing phenomena of life and death, past and future, but will remain constant without any obstructing doubts. This is the power of knowing past lives. And then the power to fly through the air. When you understand the nature of your own mind, it will thoroughly light up the dark cave of ignorance, and the original natural beauty will be manifest. In an instant, you will pass through the 10 directions without stopping in the blue sky. This is your inherent nature's true power to fly through the air. And then the power to stop deluded thoughts, the last one. When you understand the nature of your own mind, delusions will change into bodhi, wisdom. Because bodhi is your original inherent nature, it transcends delusion and enlightenment. You won't exist among sages and sinners, and won't be stained by the various phenomena. This is the power to stop deluded thoughts. Let's comment on this last one, the power to stop deluded thoughts. Who says we need to stop them? We just need to see through them. We need to see that deluded thoughts, like all thoughts, are empty. This is the fundamental realization. All things are nothing. Form is only emptiness. And emptiness is only form. Deluded thoughts become a problem when we attend to them, when we fix on them, when we react to them. That's when they become a problem. To have a deluded thought is just no problem if we just notice it and let it go. Don't dwell in these thoughts. That's the whole point. We don't need to stop them if we just leave them alone. They'll run through the mind for a shorter or longer period of time. It doesn't matter. If our attention is on our practice, then those thoughts are as though no thoughts. I'm skipping around here. It gets kind of ponderous, some of these exchanges. He goes into a lot of stuff that we don't need to read. Here, questioner. To the mundane world, fasting is refraining from eating for periods of a week, 2 weeks, up to 100 days. Is this a way to Buddhahood? Buddhahood, of course, always means full enlightenment. Basui. Do you think Basui sees fasting really as just not eating for a while? Basui, fasting does not mean refraining from the formal eating of food. It means refraining from feeding on the roots of illusion. Fasting means looking into your own nature and illuminating your consciousness, cutting off deluded feelings arising from analytical thinking, remaining apart from external phenomena and unattached to the internal void, completely purifying yourself so that things with no more than a thread of meaning become non-existent in your life. This phrase, remaining apart from external phenomena and unattached to the internal void. These are the two of the traps in practice, is getting caught by external phenomena, sights, sounds, smells, and so forth, and thoughts, getting attached to thoughts. Those are also phenomena. That's one trap. The other extreme is getting attached to emptiness, the internal void, as he says. Either of these is an attachment. It's one-sided. It's unbalanced. In pure Zazen, we are avoiding both of these attachments. Both attachment to form and attachment to emptiness. He says, a good teacher of true rank relates to people as a farmer trains his ox, as though he were depriving a starving man of food. If you were mistakenly to take this fasting literally, it would be a case of heresy. Questioner, if the essence of all the Buddhist teachings were contained in the practice of looking directly into one's nature and attaining Buddhahood, wouldn't that make the formal practice of keeping the precepts meaningless? And then Basui, keeping or violating the precepts is prior to the division of things and ideas, matter and mind, when essence and form were part of one vehicle. Having not yet seen into his own nature, a person sinks in the sea of passion and discrimination, killing his own Buddha mind. This is the murder of murders. That's why keeping the true precepts is the enlightened way of seeing into your own nature. So that's his understanding of the first precept, not to kill. And the second one, when deluded thoughts arise, you damage the Dharma treasure, destroy its merit, and hence become a thief. Next is misuse of sexuality, which traditionally is most simply called adultery. When you give rise to deluded thoughts, you cut off the seeds of Buddhahood and continue the life, death, and rebirth causing karmic activities. This is what is meant by adultery. The fourth is lying. When you are blinded by deluded thoughts, you forget your precious Dharma body, and seeing only illusion, you call it your body. This is what is meant by lying. And the fifth one is abusing alcohol and drugs. Isolated by deluded thoughts, you lose sight of your inherent wisdom and become frantic. This is what is meant by being intoxicated. The other precepts should be understood similarly. Thus, when your mind is deluded, you are breaking all the precepts. And when you see into your own nature, you are at once keeping all the precepts perfectly. The power from seeing into your own nature will extinguish all delusion and bring life to Buddha nature. This is the precept not to kill living things. If you put deluded thoughts out of your mind through the power of seeing into your own nature, you will purify the six sense organs and prevent the appearance of the six rebels. This is the precept against stealing. If you see through deluded thoughts by means of this power, the ordinary world will no longer exist. This is the precept against misusing sexuality. If you see through deluded thoughts by means of this power, you will be able to realize the manifestation of true sublime wisdom. You won't stop at expedient means, mistaking it for the true vehicle, or call the elusive physical body the real one. This is the precept against lying. And then the fifth, alcohol and drugs. When you are able to see into your own nature, you will have wisdom. You will not drink the wine of delusion and ignorance. This is the precept against alcohol and drugs. Hence, Buddha nature is the body of the precepts, and the precepts are the workings of Buddha nature. When this body is perfect, its activity lacks nothing. When you desire to mount the platform of the true precepts, you must tread upon the ground of the true self. This is the meaning behind the statement that a young monk having attained Buddhahood need not receive the precepts. Well, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.